Joe, for the chance to talk. I'm hoping to I have an agenda. I'm hoping to sell it to you, and I'm hoping to convince Richard Hill that the...
Excuse the interruption, Richard. Please turn on your...
I'm hoping that, that Richard is going to have a
burning bush moment in this talk. But if not, I'm hoping to get good feedback. So the problem I'm interested in and I want to tell you about is the back reaction of objects where we're going to be in the limit where the mass of the object is arbitrarily large, so it basically just sits there, but it's got a finite size. And what we're interested in is tracking these effects that that finite size has on its environment. So it might be things, you know, orbiting a finite size nucleus, or it could be, I don't know, the planet orbiting a finite size sun or whatever. But it's a, we're imagining that the mass is much bigger than the size, than one over the size, which is not an unreasonable limit. You know, atoms satisfy that. It's not a particularly good one for nuclei because the mass and the size are kind of the same. But you can imagine for nuclei, because I'm going to talk about nuclei, that if you look at the influence of a nucleus on the orbits of an electron, it depends in many complicated ways on the mass and the finite size. And I want to focus on a term which is independent of mass, but does depend on the finite size. And so I'm going to take this limit where the mass is large because I want to focus on those terms and not on other terms. Even though the other terms numerically, you might worry they might be comparable. And so we'll have to then ask whether they are. So the picture you should have in your mind is there's some object where little l is the finite size thing. It's a physical scale. So it might be a Fermi for a nucleus. There's a scale, a big scale that you're interested in, which might be the Bohr radius of an atom or something. And we want to systematize how the small l appears in answers, expecting it to appear in powers of l over a. And the epsilon dotted line will play a role because I want to argue for you that a framework in which to set things up systematically will divide the problem of thinking about how long distance effects depend on finite sizes by imagining drawing some Gaussian pillbox around the object. And so the dotted line is supposed to be this Gaussian pillbox and give it a radius epsilon. And because L is much smaller than A, we can choose epsilon to be much bigger than L but also much smaller than A. And then that allows you to think of the problem in two pieces where the first part is if you really knew what the object was, you could calculate the boundary data on the radius epsilon. And the advantage of having epsilon large compared to L is you can take advantage of multipole expansions and make that not an uncontrolled calculation. But once you've done that once and for all, you can take that boundary data at epsilon and then ask any question you like about large distance physics. So it's the same spirit as an effective field theory where you get rid of the short distance physics once and for all at the beginning and then apply it in a systematic way to any observable you choose to pick later. And so the long distance part of it will be to calculate how physical effects depend on this boundary data. And one of the things that you know, just like in any effective field theory, is that that scale epsilon should not be in any answers because it's just a trick in the calculation. So an important role will be played by the renormalization group, and it's just a statement that if I calculate a physical observable, it can't depend on epsilon. And that will dictate how various couplings will depend on epsilon because they're going to have to have, if you imagine changing epsilon and you've got some effective couplings being chosen on the surface, then those couplings are adjusting in such a way that the real physics didn't care about where you drew epsilon was. And that's what the renormalization group I'm talking about will be. So that's the framework. And the way I want to organize a talk is to tell you what I just told you. And then I want to write down what the effective field theory would be. This is kind of a natural effective field theory kind of language. And you'll see that when I do the definition, you have all been doing this effective field theory. So half the reactions I get from this talk is, you know, yeah. Of course, that's what you do. So I'm going to mostly do show you that because I want you to be convinced that I'm not actually proposing anything radical. And then the important part will be the boundary condition story because once you have the action, which in this case will be a point particle action, I'm going to imagine it's the world line, some action on the world line of the proton, could be the action on the world line of a magnetic monopole, some small object. Once you have that action, I want to argue for you that the way that the outside theory learns about the influence of that action is through the near source boundary conditions that are basically being imposed at epsilon, which is a very small scale from the point of view of the outside. So I want to show you that that does what you expect it to do in the case that you always use it for. That's basically the Gauss's law argument you use for electrostatics. But I want to argue for you also that this action we're talking about is an effective action. It doesn't have just one term. It has all kinds of terms, and they're organized in powers of L. And that same boundary condition argument that relates the boundary condition to the action applies to them all, not just to the Coulomb one. And that means that there's an algorithm for describing what your boundary condition should be near a source, and it needn't be the one that we were using. And in particular, I'm going to argue that in the hydrogen atom, it's not the one we're using. And because of that, we're getting the hydrogen atom a little bit wrong. And so I'll set that up by talking about, first of all, before talking about the Coulomb problem, I'll talk about the 1 over r squared potential, because that's one where it's really in your face that something's happening. But I also want to convince you that that's part of the sanity check, because there's a lot of things known about that problem. And a lot of the exotic things that happen in that problem, I want to argue, are actually quite mundane when you think of it in terms of this effective action picture, that some of the mysteries are just kind of become fairly obvious. And I think there I'm not saying anything different than anybody in the field would have said. It's just a different emphasis, with the one thing being that whereas most people would talk about an ambiguity in the boundary conditions, I'm going to give you an algorithm for calculating the boundary condition if you knew what the underlying source was. And then the last thing I'll do is I'll talk about the hydrogen atom, and the asterisk is because I'm not going to do an honest job of talking about the hydrogen atom by doing the Dirac equation, although that's a lot of that is done. I'm going to describe the spinless version of it because the physics is the same. There are some details I think that are going to change a little bit, but it doesn't change the main message. And the punchline here will be, I want to argue that the boundary condition that you use in the hydrogen atom, that the wave function be bounded at the origin, is not the right one when you have finite size effects. And I want to also argue that that statement is really pressing when the size of the object is sufficiently small that the thing orbiting it is relativistic when it gets close to the scale epsilon or L. So I'm essentially going to argue that there's more than one thing controlling the relativistic approximation, or the non-relativistic approximation in an atom. It's not just is V over C small, it's not just that the energy is close to the mass of the electron. It's also that 1 over the size, 1 over L or 1 over epsilon, has to be small compared to the mass if you want to trust the non-relativistic description. And that's the thing that's breaking down, which is kind of an unconventional thing. We don't normally think in position space in as particle physicists. And so
1 over L of proton should be less than mass of electron?
Yeah, what's going to happen, so I'm going to ask that things become interesting when this is bigger than M. Things become really interesting when Z alpha over L is bigger than M. And for an electron, this is actually basically true for a proton. This is kind of, they're basically the same size for a proton, because this is, that's more or less Z alpha squared times the, this says that L is less than Z alpha squared times the Bohr radius. And that's 10 to the minus 5, and 10 to the minus 5 of Bohr radius is where the nucleus is. And so I want to argue that these relativistic effects at the position of the source are actually becoming important, even though the energy of the orbit is non-relativistic. And so that you shouldn't be fooled into thinking that the energy of the orbit is telling you everything you need to know about the relativistic or non-relativisticness of your problem.
So are you going to say at the end that this solves the size of proton problem?
I'm going to argue that it does, yeah.
Okay.
But the reason it's only been an argument and rather than just a statement is this asterisk that I'm going to really make the argument for a spinless system, and that's not the right system. But the physics of it, I think, is the same. And we've carried the Dirac equation far enough that I think I can show you the number that changes. There's a number in one of the formulas I'm going to show. And the essence of that problem will be there's going to be some effective interactions, and they're going to be not a surprise that they're there. But the essence will be how do the coefficients of those interactions depend on the mass of the thing that's orbiting? And the prejudice is generally that they don't depend at all in a strong way. And I'm going to argue that they actually depend much more strongly than you think, and that's the resolution of the problem. That's the claim. Okay, so point particle effective field theories, what are they? So I'm in this limit where, I should have written it, that M is much, much bigger than 1 over R, and that's much, much bigger than 1 over A, or L, that's what I meant to say. And so in that limit, the thinking of the M being large part of the limit is that rather than having worrying about the recoil of the object as you bounce off of it, I just want it to sit there. And that's the limit in which it should just be setting up fields, and we should be interacting with those fields. So it'll be like interacting with a potential, a static potential. And what I want to do is I want to write a Lagrangian describing the interaction with that source of the potential, which involves higher and higher powers of L in the coupling constant. So to describe, so because M is basically going to infinity, I can take the source is static. And so my real problem will be I'll have some what I'm going to call bulk fields interacting with the center mass of the object will be a special place because it says where the object sits. So with the source's center of mass coordinate, period. And so the bulk fields, what you should think in this case, in practice, you know, it's electromagnetic field, say, and a matter field, which at various times will be either the Schrodinger field or the Klein-Gordon field or the Dirac field, depending on the context. Okay. So what would this Lagrangian look like? Well, the bulk part of it, so the action is going to come to us as a bulk part and then a source part or a particle part. And the bulk part is just going to be what it would normally be. So let's just take it to be d4x of minus the fourth of Maxwell action. And then for the matter part, I'll either choose Schrodinger, Klein-Gordon, or Dirac. And so it'll either be minus I psi star dt psi minus 1 over 2m del psi star del psi minus v of x psi star psi. Or it might be d mu psi star d mu psi minus m squared psi star psi. Or the Dirac equation. But I'll switch back and forth between these things. And I'll try to be clear when I do which one I'm doing. So I should probably use a different thing when I'm Klein-Gordoning, so that way it'll be more obvious which one I'm talking about. And so now the interesting thing will be this. This is the thing that should encode the physics of the finite size. It should be localized where the source is, because that's where the finite size is. And so that'll be the point particle action. And to start it off, it's a function of the bulk fields. It could be a function of other degrees of freedom that are localized on the source, like maybe it's got a spin or something like that. But I'm going to take the simplest case where we're just looking at a rotationally invariant source, so we won't have any extra degrees of freedom like spin to track. And there's no waves that are kind of localized. There's no modes that are localized where the source is. And then there's also going to be the position thing that's describing where the source sits. And in practice, I'm going to almost always just choose y mu to be, tau 0, 0, 0, so that y dot mu will just be delta mu 0 as the forward velocity of the source. And I'm supposed to make an action which is reparameterization variant under the taus and generally covariant and gauge invariant, blah, blah, blah. And so in practice, what I'm going to do is I'll write that as the integral d tau integral d4x, some delta function telling me that x is the same as the position of the source, and then some Lagrangian, which depends on bulk fields and on y dot, typically. And in practice, what I actually will usually do is just write down the thing with the fewest things in it. So LP, the thing that would correspond to a point particle would have been minus, say, the metric on the world line of the particle times the mass, which is the thing I'm taking to infinity. And I would have had a charge times a mu times y dot mu. That would be the point particle terms. So this is going to infinity. This gamma is just, g mu nu y dot mu. But I'm also going to add to it things that are higher dimension in the sense that they have more fields and more derivatives. And I'll start with the lowest ones. And so two things I can write down right away which have the same dimension if I think of the Schrodinger field would have been, I could have written down something involving the electromagnetic field of the form Q div E, if you like. That would be a thing I could add to this, but I'm going to write that as Q 1 plus 1 6th RP squared del squared times, actually. When I, let me actually, I'm going to write it, I'm going to combine the delta function with this, and I'm going to make this choice here to write out explicitly what I'm going to use. So plus dot dot dot. And so in particular, the point particle action will be the integral d4x of q a0 1 plus 1 6 rp squared del squared. So plus other terms involving the photon. And then I'll have also things involving the matter field. So I could have, I can imagine having something like minus h psi star psi plus other things. So. And so in particular, if this is a Schrodinger field where psi star psi has dimensions of 1 over volume, and this is a, because of the delta function, there's a volume there already, this has dimensions of length squared if this is a Schrodinger field. It would have had dimensions length if this was a Klein-Gordon field. And this also has coefficients of dimensions length squared. So in the Schrodinger case, I write them both because they're going to be, you might expect them to compete with each other because they have the same dependence on length. And the expectation is that things that are not written have involved more powers of length, and so they're going to be suppressed in the end of the day by more powers of little l over big A when we look at observables. And I've written this coefficient in this particular way because if I calculate the charge density of the source as being the action divided, you know, varied with respect to A0, I would have gotten Q 1 plus 1 6 RP squared del squared by delta function. So that says that this is the charge, the total charge. And then this is this 6, 1 6 has been chosen so that if I took this as my my charge distribution and I calculated the RMS radius, so I took the integral of the charge times r squared, and I divided by the integral of the charge, then I would have gotten rp squared. So this is what non-relativistically is what you would have called the charge radius.
Rp is the standard deviation of the...
Yeah, it's like the RMS distribution, yeah. And this is something to be identified, but we already know. In the Schrodinger case, we have a lot of intuition for what this kind of a thing should look like, because this is basically looking like this term looks like a potential term, but with a delta function. So this is very much like a delta function potential in the Schrodinger equation, if we're doing the Schrodinger case. So the effectum is V plus H in the Schrodinger case. And I tell you that because that brings a lot of intuition. So there's a lot of things that we know about charge radii, and there's a lot of things that we know about delta functions in various quantum mechanical situations. And one of the things I have to show you is that this picture, everything I tell you has to agree with those things, and they will. All right, so far that's the definition. It's kind of obvious. You've been doing it, you know, your whole life. And now the question is, what's the boundary condition story? So
let me... Can I ask briefly? So you say effective field theory. But
yeah.
Field theory,
in the sense that these are fields.
Is anything beyond the valence state relevant to what you're going to say?
The valence state.
Sorry, you just call it quantum mechanics with fixed particle number.
No, these are fields. So when I actually come to the hydrogen atom, I'm going to calculate, you know, zero field n. And that's the thing I'm going to actually solve for. So in the case of the Schrodinger field, that will be the wave function. But in the Klein-Gordon field, it's not. So what I'm doing is really field theory. The fields live in the bulk, but they're interacting with something where the physics of the, you know, of the source is restricted. So that part is less of a field.
But are real photons or shrinking particle components in the matter fields, are those relevant?
Are real photons? Certainly real photons are. This is a whole electromagnetic field, yeah. And the matter, when you mean matter, you mean protons or you mean electrons?
Electrons.
It's the whole Dirac equation. It'll be a spinless Dirac equation, but it's the whole thing. In principle, at the field level, particles and antiparticles are both there. And I'm doing that because I'm going to eventually get to the place The reason I'm doing both Schrodinger and Klein-Gordon is that I want to distinguish what happens in the when there's relativistic effects coming from the boundary being small enough that you care about relativity. But to do that, I had to keep the antiparticles.
So, yeah. I mean, I think you could have started by saying that you're just coupling your fields to some classical currents, and then all you're doing is you're localizing the currents.
As far as I've gone so far, I think that's right, yeah. Yeah. You know, I guess the delicate thing would be whether you think psi star psi is a current. And I guess for the Schrodinger case, it would be, because it's like the probability density. But once I start writing down operators, they're not all going to be conserved currents. There's going to be all kinds of things. And if
yeah,
you,
I guess I should say current.
You mean like C numbers?
Just yeah, the classical fields. I don't
yeah, know. Right. Some level, that's
not
right.
Some classical,
right, right. All right. OK, so far so good. Now I want to talk about boundary conditions. So I want to start off with the point particle thing just to show you that I'm going to do what you do anyway. So let's look at this term. If we want to know, what's nice about this term is that it's linear in the field. So if I ask, how did the Maxwell equation learn about that term? So the source contributes to the Maxwell equation. And so we're going to have something like div E is equal to the charge of the electron plus the piece coming from that source, which will be Q times delta cube of X, essentially, is what's going to happen. So what I'm doing here is I'm imagining stopping here and not including these terms. So if I wanted to formalize how you deal with this, is you do what you did in first year physics. What you do is you take your source, you surround it by some Gaussian pillbox, and then you ask what the flux is of E, where E is basically the gradient of A0. So you're asking things about the radial derivative of A0. And you have an argument that says that if I integrate this over this, let's call this Gaussian pillbox, call it G. So I integrate over G, div E, you know, I get the integral of E dot N. And that's the thing that would be equal to the integral of D3X of minus E psi star psi plus Q. And this is like the interior of G. And so to the extent that it's a very, very small interior, you're thinking that this is going to get really, really small as the size gets small. And this is the thing that survives. And so you make this argument that I take the field equation, and if I integrate it over some really small region around the source, what's special about the delta function is that it gives me an answer which doesn't care about the size of the pillbox. Smooth things do care about the size of the pillbox as they go to zero, so that you're thinking that as that gets smaller, they're going to go away. But total derivatives also care, because I integrate them, they're surface terms, and the surface term is just seeing what E is. And then you read off from this the usual thing that E goes like, you know, you had an integration constant in A0. And then this tells you how to choose that integration constant. So the integration constant is satisfying that. The way I want to write this to make it suggestive is I want to write this as R squared ddr of A0 is basically Q at R equals epsilon, where epsilon is much smaller than any other scale in your problem. And that basically tells you that A0 is, you know, Q over 4 pi R squared, which is like R, sorry, which you believed anyway. So now all I want to do now is apply the same argument to the other fields, and in particular for this term. And in this term, this is also still a standard argument, because if someone had given you the quantum mechanics of a delta function potential, the way you would have dealt with it is you would have integrated over the delta function and got some boundary condition, and that's how you would have solved the problem. You would have traded the source for a boundary condition. And so that's all I'm going to do, is that I'm going to use that technique, but systematically. So ditto for psi star psi H. So if I calculate the analog of the field equation, I'm going to get, in the Schrodinger case, we're going to get something like I dt psi plus, you know, 1 over 2m L squared psi plus V minus V psi minus H of X psi is equal to 0. And then what I would normally do is do the same argument, integrate over G, and then I won't get anything here or here if it's smooth, and if epsilon is small enough, and I'll get dominated by what's coming here and here, and it's going to tell me that the integral over G of n dot grad psi will be equal to 2m h times psi, 0. So far, I think I'm not telling you anything that you're surprised by. Where it gets a little bit more subtle is this argument where things are smooth is actually a bit of a slippery argument. Because if I'm going to start talking about inverse square potentials or things where I've got spatial derivatives, but I'm adding to it gauge fields that are also going to 1 over r, that limiting argument where you say that as you integrate over a small radius, that nothing else contributes becomes a bit of a slippery argument. So a better argument is to say that's kind of where this more formal picture comes in. What I'd like to really do is I'd like to specify boundary conditions on this Gaussian pillbox epsilon, of radius epsilon. And I'd like to first infer those boundary conditions from the source. And then I'd like to use the boundary conditions to describe the physics outside the pillbox. But the boundary conditions will not be as specific as saying what the fields are or what the derivatives directly are, because you know that the value of the field here and its derivatives is also going to depend on the other fields that are in the problem that are kind of far from the source. So an efficient way to describe the boundary information at the surface is not by saying what phi is or what the derivatives are directly. What's better is to specify a boundary action on the surface of this Gaussian pillbox, infer the properties of the boundary action from the underlying microscopic action we've been talking about. And then once you have a boundary action, you treat it the way you treat any boundary action. You vary the bulk action and the boundary action, make it stationary with respect to variations in the bulk and on the boundary. And then the boundary action is going to start changing your boundary conditions when you make the things be stationary. So I'm not going to do it in detail because basically the argument I'm telling you here is going to give you this right answer. But there's an issue that you might worry about that you shouldn't worry about. So what we'll really do is we'll imagine we'll have a boundary action at r equals epsilon. And then the equations of motion we're going to use are delta delta psi star of the bulk and the boundary actions are 0 with respect to delta psi both in the bulk and on the boundary. And this thing, the variation on the boundary will be the thing that turns into the boundary condition, which is going to turn into things like this. It'll be statements like n dot, the radial derivative of something will be related to the value of the coupling. And in practice, what's going to happen, probably not important. So one other thing I want you to get from this is that this, the boundary condition you get from here is something along the lines of 4 pi r squared d psi dr, d psi ddr of log psi at r equals epsilon is equal to 2m h, which I'm going to call lambda. And I want you to, I'm going to come back to the fact there's an m here. So when we get to the hydrogen atom later on, an issue will be these terms in our effective Lagrangian, do they depend on the mass of the particle in the orbit? Little m is the mass of the electron, say. And normally, I think the intuition would be that if I wrote down an interaction like I erased there, or I know that this one here, you're expecting that none of these effective interactions should care about the mass of the particle doing in the orbit, because I get those things by integrating out physics at small. But the precise statement of that is that the physics of the source is independent of who is orbiting. But to learn what that means for H, you have to do a matching calculation where you actually calculate the physical thing from H and ask, what does it mean for the nucleus not to care the difference between an electron and a muon? And where I'm going to argue later, part of what I'm going to argue later on is the physics of the nucleus is telling you this. So we should expect this to not depend on the mass of the electron or the muon. But that means that H will depend on the mass of the electron and the muon inversely, because the statement that the nucleus doesn't care who's orbiting it is the statement that this is independent of M, not that H is independent of M, and it can't, they can't both be independent of M, is the bottom line.
So can I ask this? So why do you have to introduce this radius epsilon? Why can't you just write all the derivatives of the field at that point and basically do a gradient expansion?
You, in principle, I am. So this was a gradient expansion term.
Right, exactly. And but then you don't have to do the epsilon this way.
Well, generically, from what I've told you so far, it looks that way. But if actually, when I start talking about the inverse square potential, you could have given me a hard time about this argument where I neglect everything else when I do these pillbox integrals. And you could have said, really, the boundary condition I'm identifying is wrong, because these things that are singular as r goes to 0 were contributing the way I argued it here. But this argument is a cleaner argument where this argument makes it clear that the only thing that contributes from the bulk action only contributes to the boundary condition through the things that you're integrating by parts as you vary things. So it only cares about the kinetic terms and doesn't care about things like the potential. So it's a subtlety which.
But inverse R is not really part of the action. It's not in the QED action. It's something that if you solve, it comes.
Yeah, here I'm imagining I'm using the Schrodinger action.
Right,
so
right.
So since then this would have been in the action. I would have had a V psi star psi. See, the whole issue is going to be that when you start changing the boundary condition, solutions are going to become more singular than you thought they were at the origin. And so then as you start to talk about things at the origin, things are diverging there that they didn't used to diverge. And there'll be a story about how you make sense of that. And these effective couplings are going to be what renormalize those divergences. So the boundary condition is central to everything, essentially, because it's the thing that if you know the boundary condition, you have no option as to how your fields behave at the origin, because the boundary condition told you how they behave. And this need not be the same as the requirement that the field be bounded at the origin. Typically, if H is 0, this becomes the statement that the things are bounded at the origin, but it's not generically true. And so if you ask, why do you believe that things should be bounded at the origin, there's two reasons to believe that that's not the right criterion. One is you certainly didn't believe it for the Coulomb potential, the Coulomb field, and we're just talking about another field. So there's no principle that says that fields don't diverge where sources are. And secondly, when we do the inverse square potential, what's special about it is that for the S wave, both solutions diverge at the origin. And so whatever the criterion is that tells you how to choose amongst them, it's not finiteness at the origin. So then the question is, what is it? And I'm trying to sell you that this is the right criterion in any situation.
What are the restrictions on epsilon? So I think one of your points is going to be that for hydrogen, there's a region where relativistic effects become important.
Yeah. Because I have to choose this, that 1 over L is much bigger than 1 over epsilon, which is much bigger than 1 over A. And so the problem is that the nucleus has a fixed size. And if I imagine taking my wave function for the electron and coming in and asking, how do I learn about what's going on in the nucleus? If you don't let me get to the relativistic regime, I never get to the nucleus. And so then I can't ask that question. And so that's basically, I think, the failure. I think that the standard way of approaching things in terms of perturbing around the Schrodinger problem kind of presupposes the boundary condition. And then the problem is that you're really perturbing around the wrong boundary condition. And so what should happen is that there will be graphs, and I think I can, in this language, I can tell you what the graphs are that are you're losing control of. And so if you resum them, it just tells you, use the boundary condition that I'm telling you. So there's a self-consistency to these boundary conditions. But I'd like to get to that at the end, if you don't mind, because that's the thing I understand the least is, where exactly does the standard calculation get it wrong that's not using this large M limit? And that's that I tied up with that.
So suppose rather than a circle for the dotted line, you drew some other surface that had multiple epsilons associated with it.
Okay.
And then you demanded they all drop out in the way that you've done with epsilon.
Yeah.
Would that fix something additional, or would that just be something?
No, I think that's kind of a coordinate artifact. It's like Weinberg's second law of theoretical physics, right? You can use any variables you like, but if you use the wrong ones, you'll be sorry. And so a related version of that question would be, I'm talking about everything like it's spherically symmetric, but what if it had a multipole moment or something? And in principle, what you could do is you could use a multipole expansion and you'd encode the moments by the angular dependence of your data on the surface. But the exact shape of the surface, I don't think it plays an important role, although I have to say that I've always not used the easiest shape. All right. So far, we're at the end of point one. You know what I mean by effective action. you know what I mean by the boundary conditions, and it's basically this, and I've written them down essentially, that in the, all that went into these boundary conditions was that I had something of the form del squared psi and a delta function psi, or I had something linear in the field so that the equation didn't depend on the field at all. And the only really new thing about having something quadratic in psi or even higher powers of psi is that you have to now start asking, your boundary condition cares what your field is doing at the origin, whereas it didn't really over there. And so the fact that things could be diverging is now a pressing issue, that you have to decide how to deal with that. And that's why you need to regularize, and that's where this epsilon is coming in. Okay.
Why do you think 1/r² comes from?
Okay, that's what I'm going to do next, and that's, I'm doing that because it's an example of where there's a lot of weird things that happen.
Okay.
And so in particular, there's a claim that if you have the 1/r² potential and it's repulsive but not too repulsive, there's a unique bound state, depending on how you set the problem up. But you can also set the problem up in a way where it doesn't have a bound state, and that sounds weird. And I want to translate that to this language, and it becomes really mundane. So what's going on is, since you asked, let me start. All right, so this is really a warm-up. So there's two reasons for doing it. This is a conceptual warm-up to show you that I'm not crazy, or there's no evidence that I'm crazy. That's a different statement. And I'm going to reproduce what people get, but I'm going to string a slightly different set of words around it. And the one thing that's different is that I'm going to give you an algorithm for the boundary condition, which I think in the literature they regard that as being just a basic ambiguity of the problem. And I'm tying that to this action of the source. So if you know the action of the source, you know what the boundary condition is my message. And that's the only new thing in this case. But it's also true that in the relativistic hydrogen atom, there's a 1/r² term. And so what I'm going to tell you about this system, I'm going to claim actually is relevant to the hydrogen atom. All right, so let's again do the Schrodinger problem. So our field equation is let's do the time independent one. So we'll have minus del squared over 2m psi, and let's take an attractive 1/r² term. So we'll have minus g over r squared psi, and then we'll have plus h psi equal to e psi. So this is the non-relativistic quantum mechanics of the 1/r² potential. So I want to do this example because this is an example. What's nice about this example is that if I wrote this out in polar coordinates, you know that there's a piece which is going to go like, there'll be 1/r² ddr of r squared d psi dr term. But there's also a piece which is L plus 1 over 2m r squared. And what's important about this term is that this term starts to fight this term. And because of that, it starts to modify the small r limit of the wave functions or the fields. And so if g were 0, then what you know is that the two solutions, the two radial solutions, say r1 of r and r2 of r, say r plus minus and r, one goes like r to the l and one goes like r to the minus l minus 1. And that's coming from the fact that if you stick in that ansatz r to a power into here, you get basically power plus 1 times 1/r². And so the way you solve this equation, you say that the power is equal to L, or it's minus L plus 1. That's the solution to SS plus 1 is equal to LL plus 1 is that. So the general solution is the sum. So now, if g were 0, the party line would be that you throw this one away because it's singular, you keep this one, and you're good. But what happens when g is not 0 is because it's not 0 and it's competing with this, the statement here is that this goes like r to the nu, r to the minus nu minus 1, where nu plus 1 is L plus 1 minus 2mg. And so you see that as g gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then nu gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But the important thing is that for the S wave, both of these solutions, nu is small but negative if g is small. And so for small non-zero g, nu is bigger than 0 sorry, less than zero.
It depends on the sign of the G, right?
What's that?
It depends on the sign of the G.
Definitely, yeah. So I'm talking about attractive potentials.
Attractive.
That's why that sign is there. Yeah, and what's happening is that because it's attractive, it's undermining the Anger-Momentum barrier. And so that's giving you more of a sample of the origin. And the message is that the more you sample the origin, the more the solution cares about what the action was at the origin that's describing what the physics was there. Okay, so what this tells you is that because both R plus and R minus go to infinity as R goes to zero, that means that your criterion, the usual criterion, won't work. What you should be using is a criterion like the one I'm telling you about. And so the way that this is described in the literature is that they don't necessarily tell you that this has to be there. They would say that's not there. And then they would say that there's the way that they phrase this ambiguity of the boundary condition is that they recognize that they have one because they can't use the old choice. And then they say, well, a way to organize how to think about the boundary condition is that it's basically there's a choice to be made and it should be self-adjoint because you don't want to lose probability to whatever's going on at the origin. So people ask for a self-adjoint extension, which is essentially a choice of boundary condition which satisfies that there's no probability flux at the origin. And it's not unique, as you might imagine. And so if you use my rule for any, I say my rule like it's my rule. There's a whole bunch of collaborators in the room here. So there's the human, Marcus, Emil, not as low, and there's a bunch of accents I'm getting wrong here. And Matt Williams. Peter, Marcus. I think that's everybody. Did I forget anybody? And of course, a lot of these rules people have known for a long time, so we're just kind of providing a framework. So any real action, if you crank it through this rule, will give you a self-adjoint extension. And so you can kind of see that part of the freedom you had in choosing a self-adjoint extension was what was the action that you were interacting with. And there's also nothing required by the self-adjoint extension. If you have a physical system that is losing probability at the origin, and an example of which is if you have a trapped set of atoms and there's a wire in the bottom, which if the atom hits the wire, it gets kicked out of the trap, then the effective theory in that case won't be self-adjoint. And so you should be able to parameterize what it looks like. And the way you would do it is you write down an action like this, where as long as the wire is small, you have some effective description. It's just now the coefficients don't have to be real. So there's a utility to this because it gives you a physical principle for deciding what the boundary conditions are. And in particular, because at low energies, it's often true that the leading thing is quadratic in the fields, when I get to the renormalization group equation that we're going to talk about, it's always the same equation. And it's universal because that term is typically dominating at low energies. And so there's a reason why it's special compared to other boundary conditions you could have chosen. Okay. So the party line for this potential is you make some choices, and then you find bound states. And and the reason that people talk about it is that if you didn't have this term, or actually even if you do have that in three dimensions, if you don't have that term, this is scale invariant, right? That this goes like 1 over r squared, this goes like 1 over r squared. So if I gave you some solution which had a bound state energy, you're expecting I should get a continuum of solutions by doing scale transformations. So how can there be any bound states is the statement. And it's used as an example of dimensional transmutation because what you do is you regulate, what people normally do is they regulate this 1 over r squared potential at some small epsilon, and they quantize that system, and they take the potential to be something which is cut off at r equals epsilon, and that system is not scale invariant. They find energy levels, and then they draw conclusions. But one of the drawbacks is that everything depends on epsilon, and there's a question of what that means. And the statement is, so the party line statement would be that if you did that exercise, and you look for the bound states, and what you get is if g is bigger than a quarter, you get an infinite number. G, I mean 2mg, is bigger than a quarter. But if 2mg is less than a quarter. So this kind of makes sense. If the well is deep enough, you get a lot of bound states, is what they're saying, which is not crazy. But if this is true, you might have thought, well, if you're kind of below the point where you get any bound states, you shouldn't get any bound states. And the statement here is, it depends on what you did with the boundary conditions. So either no bound states, or one bound state, depending on how you set the problem up. And what's interesting is that the one bound state actually extends down to slightly negative values of G, which is repulsive potentials, which is very counterintuitive. But what's going on is the boundary condition you should have been using is you should have had an effective action there because the wave functions are being piled up near the origin, so they care about what the physics is at the source. Once you put in an action like that, and so you get a boundary condition, which essentially is something like this, what's happening is you've got a delta function. And you'll see in a second that the lesson is that when you have an inverse square potential, you have to have a delta function. It's not like you have an option of having a delta function as you would in a Coulomb potential. And that delta function is where the bound state came from. So what's happening, and this is typically attractive. And so what's happening in this regime is that the one over r squared potential is not binding anything. And the one state is the one state you expected a delta function to have. So this is the delta function state. And the conditions for its existence is essentially you're asking for the delta function to be attractive and for the bound state to be big compared to the epsilon, essentially. And if that's satisfied, then you'll have that state. But you can set the problem up differently. If you set it up with H, you had to choose H. That's the choices you're making here. And you could have set it up where the delta function was repulsive, and then it wouldn't have had a bound state. So the properties of the system are kind of obvious once you see that this really implied this, that you had no option but to have something going on at the source. OK? I want to leave that there. So I think now the next thing I'd like to talk about is I alluded to a renormalization group, and that's going to play a role. So things, what you find for this bound state is that the energy of the bound state depends on epsilon. So what does that mean? And what it means is, so the right statement, I think, is that the energy doesn't depend on epsilon. But there is a dimensional transmutation going on, because what's happening is, because you've changed the bound state, so the boundary condition that we're using now, the boundary condition says that 4 pi r squared d psi ddr of log psi, that's the thing that was equal to this, 2mh, which I'm calling lambda. So if h is not 0, then this boundary condition says that the radial function that we had has c minus not equal 0 if lambda is not equal 0. And because of that, you've got solutions that are diverging, some more strongly than others, at the origin. And when you start talking about things like how does this thing affect the energy levels, you might have been tempted to say, well, it's the h times the wave function at the origin. The wave function at the origin is actually diverging because it's acquiring one over epsilon dependence to it. And so you need a way of controlling the fact that this boundary condition means that the boundary condition implies that the series in H, you're doing a series in basically M over epsilon, MH over epsilon, which is dimensionless, and that's something which need not be small. You're doing a series in make a sense here, boundary condition implies series in and also 2mg. Those are your two dimensionless things, and those things are not, perturbing an H is not necessarily the right thing to do if epsilon is too small. So how do you deal with that? The nice thing is that the renormalization group resums that for you, and it's possible to deal with the whole answer as a function of MH over epsilon without working perturbatively. And the way you do that is you recognize that this is the thing that tells you what the bound state energies are, right? What you'd normally do is you'd have some, the way you get a bound state energy, let's say, or any physical thing, but let's take bound state energies. So you would say that I want psi to be normalizable at infinity. And that tells me that c minus over c plus is equal to something, some function of the parameters, f of params. and of the momentum. And in the standard calculation we're using, a standard boundary condition, C minus equals zero would have said that kappa is being described now by, this is one boundary condition, this is another boundary condition, this is the R equals zero, this is the R equals infinity. And your quantization condition would have been normally that if this is zero, this is being asked to vanish, and that tells you what kappa is. What's happening now is that this is not zero, it's something basically proportional to lambda. And so what you find for your bound state energies is going to depend on lambda and on epsilon. But you know that nothing physical can depend on epsilon. So the way you learn about how to resum this series in particular is you take dd epsilon of this equation. This is true for all epsilon because epsilon was not unique. It takes some range of values. Take dd epsilon of this equation. That has to be zero, but you should be holding fixed kappa and all the other physical things. But you're allowing things like lambda to vary. So this will be something which this condition tells you how lambda depends on epsilon. And there's a solution for it. So the condition you get in that way is a simple one. And I'm telling you what it is in detail because it's going to be relevant in the hydrogen case. So what you find is that epsilon d lambda, so I wanted to find lambda hat to be a lambda divided by 2 pi epsilon plus 1. So you should keep in mind that lambda hat equals 1 corresponds to lambda equals h equals 0. So that's the absence of a coupling. And what you find is that epsilon d lambda hat d epsilon is equal to zeta over 2, 1 minus lambda hat over zeta squared. Where zeta is related to the coefficient of the 1 over r squared term that I just erased. V was minus g over r squared. So zeta is the square root of 1 minus 8mg. And it's defined by if r plus goes like r to the a, and r minus goes like r to the b, and a is bigger than b, then a minus b is zeta. That's how it's defined. And so what you find, the nice thing is that the criterion that lambda has to satisfy to make any physical observable epsilon independent doesn't make reference to the observable. It's something which is basically a property of the system. And this can be integrated. And it gives a flow diagram which looks like so you see that it has a fixed point at lambda hat equals plus or minus zeta, because then this vanishes. So there are fixed points at lambda hat equals plus or minus zeta. And if you did a plot of the lambda hat versus log of epsilon, and this is zeta, and this is minus zeta, what happens is that the flow starts for epsilon equals 0 at minus zeta, and then there's two classes of flows, depending on whether you're between these lines or not. If you're between the lines, there's a flow that goes up, eventually goes through zero, and then it asymptotes to plus. So the flow is that way, where this is as epsilon increases. And the other flow starts here too, but it at some point has a pull, and it comes back down again, and it approaches on this side. Now, if g had been zero, zeta would be one, and one is the place where the couplings vanish. So that says that if you were not doing an inverse square potential, these fixed points are actually vanishing coupling. So it made sense in a renormalization group invariant way to choose the coupling H to vanish. And if you made that choice at any one scale, it would stay made. So, but that's only true if G is 0. So if G equals 0, lambda equals 0 is fixed point. So lambda equals 0 at any epsilon implies lambda equals 0 for all epsilon. But if g is not 0, then the fixed point is instead zeta, which is the square root of 1 minus 8mg, which is less than 1 for g small. So in that case, this is the place where zero coupling would have been.
So how can we see that g equal to 0 in that case lambda equal to 0 is this point?
Because lambda equals 0 is the same as lambda hat equals 1, because lambda hat is lambda plus 1.
Okay.
That's what it is. So what's happening is that if G is not zero, supposing you knew that at some scale lambda was zero, that would be here, let's say. It cannot be zero at all scales, and so that means that it's around at other scales to contribute to observables, and it will not generically be true that it will generically be true that physical quantities change. If you ask the question, which I had asked here, under what circumstances is it true that C is equal to zero? It turns out that C minus is equal to zero is always a solution, even including these terms. These terms here vanish if lambda hat is equal to zeta. So if you're at this fixed point, this one here, what happens is that you get the same answer you would have gotten if you didn't hear my boundary condition story. But if you're not here, then something happens. And so, and it kind of physically makes sense that you flow at in the infrared for large distances to this place where there's nothing happening. Because in that case, you've made the system so large that you're inside the system. So that's a summary of the inverse square potential. This dimensional transmutation that happened is, if you go back and ask what were the energies given by, the energies are proportional to what 1 over epsilon star times some quantum numbers, where epsilon star is the renormalization group invariant way of describing these flows. For these flows, it could be the place where it passes through zero. For these flows, it could be the place where it passes to goes through infinity. So it's the analog of the QCD scale for these flows. And so the thing that gives you the scale when you transmute is the renormalization group invariant scale of this coupling, the delta function coupling, which I erased, which you wouldn't have known was there if you didn't realize that there was an effective action at the origin. So I'm out of time, so I'm going to really now, I can just collect these things and tell you the story of the hydrogen atom.
Quick question. How many balances do you have then? Do you have the same story of the number of balances?
Yeah, that doesn't change. So what happens is there's something here, there's some function of some quantum number, and that's whatever it is. And in the way they would have told it to you is they would have said there's some scale which they would have related to epsilon. They would have given you this formula, the correct formula. They would have given it to you as a function divided by epsilon, but where this function also depends on lambda of epsilon. And effectively, this formula is this formula where lambda goes to infinity. I chose that particular scale. That's another way of saying it. So it's like in QCD. If you told me the QCD coupling and the scale where you measured it, I know everything. But it's easy to write the formula if you write it in terms of the QCD scale, usually. So now, what's the relevance to hydrogen? So, I'm going to really just telegraphically do the Schrodinger case. In the Schrodinger case, relevance to hydrogen. In the Schrodinger case, there need not be any relevance because in the Schrodinger case, V was, you know, was Z alpha over R. And this did not change the behavior of the wave functions at the origin. So in this renormalization group story, it's as if you have a delta function, if you chose to have a delta function, it would run, but zero is a fixed point, so it doesn't have to run. You don't have to have it. There are situations where you might want it. So a famous one is if you have a proton and a pion orbiting one another, then the pion and the proton also experience a short-range nuclear interaction at the proton. And that's something which can be described in this way. And if you ask what the effective action is, there's a parameter H, which you can trade for a normalization group invariant scale epsilon. It runs because we're assuming it's not zero at some scale, because that's where we imagine nuclear physics tells us what it is. And you can relate H of epsilon or epsilon star to the energy level shifts of the S wave pion, which you can measure. Or you can do a scattering calculation with the same action, and you can relate it to the scattering length. So the pi minus p scattering length. And if you, since you've got a formula for both these things in terms of one parameter, you can invert it and get this in terms of this. And it turns out to be delta E over E is 4 As over N times the Bohr radius. And this is a formula that was first written down before I was born, which maybe that's not a unique experience for you, but it's much more rare for me these days. It's called the Deser formula, which is relating pionic energy level shifts, which you can measure as the pions cascade down with X-rays, emit X-rays, to the scattering length of the pion with the proton. So they can be there, but they need not be there. And so there need not be a story that's relevant for the muonic atoms. So what's the story for the muonic atoms? For muonic atoms, the issue is that, so for the Klein-Gordon atom, that's the star part of it, we're interested in a wave function, which is a field between sandwiched with this atomic state. And because phi satisfies the linear equation, u does as well. So u will satisfy that, that d mu minus m squared on u will be equal to 0. And there will be a boundary condition, which will be the analog of what phi satisfied. And it'll be something like 4 pi r squared ddr of log psi will be lambda for some lambda, where lambda will be proportional to h. I won't be coy, I'll just write it. It's 2 times the energy of the state times h. So I'm imagining that, that u goes like e to the minus I omega t. So omega is the energy of the state. And the reason that we care about the energy of the eigenvalue for this u is that if we calculate correlation functions, you know, phi of x, phi of y, then the poles of this are going to be the physical energy eigenstates, and the intermediate states where it's these ends are going to pick up these values as the poles. And so calculating these energy eigenvalues is a way of getting at the energy eigenfunctions in the real system. Okay. So now the important thing about the story is that if you look at this term, the d0 term squared, that's really omega plus z alpha over r squared. And so the radial equation for u satisfies, so the radial equation is something like del squared minus 2 omega z alpha over r minus z alpha squared over r squared. U is equal to kappa squared u, where I'm imagining that omega squared is minus kappa squared plus m squared. So I'm looking for a bound state where the energy is a little bit less than that in the mass. So you see that when you do the radial equation for the Klein-Gordon story, it's the same as the Schrodinger story, but it's being done with an inverse square and a Coulomb potential. And so the story I told you for the inverse square potential is relevant because it means that, as people know for the Klein-Gordon equation and the Dirac equation, the S wave states are both singular at the origin, and there's an issue as to what you choose. Landau and Lifshitz says you choose the least singular one, which is to say you choose that integration constant C minus to be 0. That's Landau and Lifshitz. But if you're doing this problem where you have pionic things and there's something going on at the origin, that's the wrong choice. And the choice I told you is the one that gets you this answer, which is the right answer. And so it's a physical choice you have to make, but it's there. And you can ask, kind of, when is this important? You might have said that in the, I forgot to say, the punchline is that in this problem, you do not have an option of choosing h to be 0 because h runs, it's like it does there. If you knew that it was 0 at any scale, it's not 0 at all scales because we know that g is not 0. In this case, g, 2mg is basically z alpha squared. And so it's always true that even if you thought that h was 0 at some scale, it's not 0 at other scales. And that's what the classical renormalization is telling you. When is this important? When does this story start to differ from this story? The important scale should be, so 1 over r loses to 1 over r, so z alpha, 2m z alpha, let's say this m z alpha over r loses to z alpha squared over r squared when r is less than z alpha over m, which is this is the z alpha squared times the Bohr radius that I told you about. So it's precisely here that this z alpha squared term is starting to become crucial. And that's kind of more or less where the edge of where for a proton, this is about a Fermi. This is about actually several Fermi. And this is about a Fermi. But as soon as if z is 1, it's a Fermi. Once z is 2, then it's already 8 Fermi. And then it gets worse from there. So that means that this 1 over r squared thing is not just an academic issue. it distinguishes the electron from the muon, because for the muon, the Bohr radius is smaller because the mass is smaller, and this is deep within the inside the nucleus, so you wouldn't run into this relativistic issue. So the punchline for the proton radius is, I've told you a story, and that story involved a calculation of the energy level shifts. And so if I do, if I put the equations behind the words that I told you about, I find the quantization condition and see how it cares about the boundary condition, you're led to the prediction that delta E over E for the S wave only, because it has to see the origin, is so it's minus 2m squared epsilon z alpha over n cubed zeta minus lambda hat over zeta plus lambda hat, where you remember zeta is that thing I've been talking about right along. It's the square root of, in this case, 1 minus 4 z alpha squared. And it's the thing that's also appearing in the renormalization group. If I wrote that in terms of epsilon star, that solves. That's easier. That's an easier way to write it. If the lambda hat went to infinity, this is a renormalization group invariant, because the lambda dependence has epsilon dependence that's just designed to cancel the explicit dependence. So that's kind of what the renormalization group does for you. So you might as well write this in terms of a convenience scale, which would be epsilon star times sig alpha over n cubed, where epsilon star is where lambda hat goes to infinity. Equally well, you could write it, if you knew that h went through 0 at some scale epsilon naught, there's a similar formula for it. And the only difference there is that if you use, because the difference between the fixed point and 0 is order z alpha squared, what happens is that if you write this in terms of epsilon naught is there's another factor of z alpha squared. So this also goes like epsilon naught m squared z alpha to the fifth. So what's the bottom line? The bottom line would be that we should compare this. What we want to do is compare this energy level shift to the energies of electrons and muons in an atom. And it's going to depend on the choices for which trajectory we're on.
Just to check, dimensionally, what's going on?
This is delta E.
Oh.
All right. Thank you. That's right. Yeah, that's delta E.
So epsilon is size and everything else, and mass of energy.
Epsilon is length. Yeah, so the dimensions are all in the epsilon m squared. What's unusual is the linearity in epsilon. The finite size effects normally come in quadratically. And so the last thing I want to say is, the first thing I wrote down for you had a piece in it which looked like the finite charge radius of the source. And so how does that appear? And I was hoping that I haven't erased it. But I have, but it's easy to state. So the simplest way to phrase this, so we want to compare this to what people see. So one way to think about this is that you recognize this, right? This basically, if we've been doing the Coulomb problem the old-fashioned way, then the wave function at the origin squared would have been z alpha m over n cubed over pi or something. So this is like something proportional to the wave function of the origin. So this is as if we had a delta function that we were perturbing in. So delta E is like H effective times the Coulomb wave function at the origin, where H effective would have been any one of these formulas. Let's take that one. It'd be 2m squared epsilon star, 2 pi m squared epsilon star, period, I think. That's right. And that's 4 pi times the m squared times the scattering length in this Klein-Gordon case. So the reason I'm writing it this way is that supposing that I give you h of epsilon, let's say h epsilon is given to you at scale epsilon. The issue about comparing to the muon and the electron energy levels is, you know, I can get anything I want if I start making up m dependences of these h's. And so the issue is, what's the physically reasonable choice for the m dependence of these h's? And the argument I want to make is that you should start with the physics that the nucleus doesn't care who's orbiting it. And that means that the boundary condition that the wave function has at the near nucleus limit should also not care who's orbiting it. And that's also what you would have found if you had an explicit model of the nucleus where all the charge was on the surface, let's say. You would have taken something with smooth at the origin, integrated out, and learned through a jump condition what the what d psi dr was at the at epsilon. That should not depend on whether it's electron or a muon. But that is not the same statement that h is independent of the mass, because this is the thing that's controlled by lambda, and lambda is 2mh. So what I should really do is I should take this thing, I should imagine taking h at some scale. There's one remaining issue, that there's one complication that I'll tell you about in a second. And then I should calculate epsilon star, and then compare that to the formula with the assumption that this h epsilon is proportional to 1 over m. That's the juice of the statement. And that's coming from the statement that the boundary condition is independent of m. But those are, you can't have them both. You have to either have an m-dependent boundary condition or an m-dependent h, this particular m-dependence. And it matters because the energy level shift cares about h through h effective, because that knows about this. And the running of h, the thing that has a universal running is lambda, not h. It's mh is the thing that runs universally. So even if they were, if h was chosen in an m-independent way at some scale, it would be m-dependent at other scales. So the normalization group invariant scale, or quantum statement, is the one that ties to the physics, and that says that the physics should not be m-dependent. And that's why h should be m-dependent in this way. The one complication is, remember we had two interactions at the same order. We had minus h psi star psi, I'm calling it h epsilon now, but we also had minus, you know, ze over 6 rp squared times del squared a0. I can integrate out the electromagnetic field. So let's call it div e. If I use the Maxwell equation, if I integrate out the electromagnetic field, I replace this by minus e psi star psi plus ze times the delta function. If I put that back into here, what happens is that this term with this gives me another contribution that looks like this. So they're related to each other once I integrate out the electromagnetic field. So the h that I should compare to experiment is actually h total, if you like, which is the naive h plus the contribution of that, which is 1/6 z e squared or p squared. So this is independent of the mass. And that's where a lot of the intuition is coming from, that the charge radius that came from the electromagnetic field, that should be independent of the mass. It's this contact interaction that should not be independent of the mass if the physics of the nucleus is species independent. So the bottom line is I want to write down a formula for what the prediction is. This statement is a prediction for what the effective coupling should be as a function of m. And because it depends on m, it can be different for muons and electrons. And you can ask, do reasonable numbers give you what's seen? Because they're measured to be different. So h effective, it turns out, if you calculate epsilon star, it turns out to be h epsilon plus 2 pi over 3 z alpha rp squared plus 2 pi epsilon z alpha squared over m. 1 plus m h epsilon times epsilon. Oops, sorry, divided by 2 pi epsilon plus 1/3 z alpha m r p squared over epsilon. So this formula is what I do is I just take this formula, I calculate epsilon star given this initial condition for some epsilon, and that's what I get in a, you know, if I drop things that are subdominant. So you can kind of see that if z alpha had been 0, and if I could drop this term and work perturbatively in h, that goes away, I get the standard answer. I would have gotten that there's a contact contribution plus the standard thing I get from the charge radius of the electromagnetic field, and that would be the standard prediction. If I throw this away, that is what, if you look up in the CoData tables what the formula is for the energy level shift, it's you take h equal to this, plug it into that, and that's the standard formula. So the correction is coming about because that needn't have been small. And these things are not necessarily small. And these are coming from the fact that zeta is not 1, so the fixed point is not at 0. And how big they are depends on what epsilon is. So here's a table of numbers which work. So if I say that here's epsilon, here's r sub p, what you should be doing is fitting the formula for the energy levels to this formula, where the thing you're fitting to is epsilon and rp. And but rather, sorry, what you're fitting is not epsilon and RP, but it's a combination of H epsilon and RP, and they're not independent because H epsilon and epsilon are designed to make things not dependent epsilon. So I'm going to call it quantity B, which is 6mH divided by Z theta E squared. So this is I'm going to choose this in a way which does not depend on M because I'm building in that H, I think, should go like 1 over M. And this is now, and I'm giving you the answers in Fermi. Take 1, 5, and 10 Fermi. Then what you find if you compare, so this is not a fit. There's two data points, and I'm making this curve go through those two data points, so there's an answer. And it's not as trivial as it sounds, because if you threw this away, then you can't make the curve go through the points. And if you threw away the normalization group, and you kept, so if you kept those two terms only, you can't make it work. If you said that epsilon was big enough, if epsilon was bigger than a Fermi, then the approximations where you start dropping terms like this, this whole formula is actually important in making this work. It's not true that you can just stop and just say, I've got something 1 over m plus something independent of m. In a way that I can, if someone asks, I can. So basically what happens is that this doesn't depend much on epsilon, which you might have expected. And what you're expecting is that this should be linear in epsilon, because that's what we found, is that it's the thing that's important is this ratio of mh over epsilon. And so this is turns out to scale like epsilon. It's 3.089, 15.49, and 30.99. So the message there is not that you believe those numbers are what God is telling us. It's that there's a better fit you can be doing, I think, to these experiments. And the prejudice that is coming in at the level of where do the m's go? And in particular, does that guy depend on m? And the argument I'm making is that the physics should be that the boundary condition at the origin or near the nucleus doesn't care about whether it's an electron or muon. And that is not a statement that H is independent of M. It's a statement that H is inversely proportional to M. And with that statement, things work fine. The caveats are that this is all spinless electrons. The Dirac equation basically is very similar because if I square the Dirac equation, it becomes a Klein-Gordon equation. So what changes is this numerical factor is a little bit different. Like it might be 3 rather than, or 2 rather than 1, but it's not, nothing is changing in an important way, I don't think. Thank you for your time. Sorry to run late.
Time for a quick question.
So are you just saying that you have new parameters that you can fit for to explain the data, basically? Is that?
It's more than just that. It's partly that. So you've got H. And I think, you know, Richard, among others, has said that if you're free to choose the H's any way you like, then you've got two things suggested you can get the experiment.
Yeah.
So the question is that you physically don't think that protons should care what's orbiting it. And the question is, what does that say about the mass dependence of all these things? So the content is in that statement. The statement that H is going like 1 over M is the physics of what I'm telling you.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, is there a way to test this, basically?
So what you do is you scatter things from, you know, scatter electrons, they're going to do it anyway. Scatter electrons from the nuclei, scatter muons from nuclei. And what this is going to predict is the scattering is going to have a contribution from these same parameters. And what this predicts is that the electron and energy shifts in atoms should agree with the scattering experiments. And the muonic energy shifts in atoms should agree with muonic scattering experiments, but they're going to stay different from each other.
You say again the inputs to the table, you take them and code the value for the hydrogen.
I took this formula, we took this formula, and we compared the answer, put this into that formula for the energy shift, compared to the codata answers, and asked what, for the different choices of epsilon, what would H and RP have to be to get them to agree.
And so your argument is that muonic hydrogen is insensitive to these effects.
Yes.
And the answer to the question is, what is the prediction? So it's a post-diction, but the post-diction is the muonic hydrogen.
Yeah, the prediction is how the scattering experiments are going to fit in, but the post-diction would be that if you define an effective charge radius to be, take this answer and call it this for some R, you're going to get a different R for muon as you collect from the electron, and those things will agree with experiment. The way that the species comes in is through M, and they will agree with experiment if you choose this to be inverse in the mass, which is the criterion of having the nucleus not care about who's orbiting. So it's a prediction for the antipanic, but I don't know how you, ideally you get a third particle with different mass and then we're in business.
So what I'd like to understand better is that you're looking for effects that are coming from modes which are less than one over the mass of the particle.
Yes.
And these are relativistic modes.
Right.
And should be integrated out in a low energy, non-relativistic theory.
Right.
With the effects accounted for by local interactions,
right.
And that's exactly what NRQED
right.
Does.
So the physical question in that case.
Okay. Sorry, and then the what I don't yet understand is how that conventional picture, how you're saying you match on to that picture, because it should be possible to match on to that picture.
I agree. Although I think that there's two, so the way, my understanding of this is that you could certainly define a low energy effective theory where you integrate out the positron, but what you're not guaranteed is that once you've done that, if I give you a source like a proton that's much smaller than the radius where things become relativistic, that you're going to be able to understand that in a controlled way. So my suspicion is what's going, and I should say right up front, that at the exact place where the standard calculations are getting it wrong, I'm not sure if I can put my finger on, but two things that I worry about are, one thing is the boundary conditions that people are using at the origin are the ones that are standard, basically. If you translate the boundary condition at the origin here to the case where the proton was a field, you're making a statement about how things behave in the coincidence limit. And that's a subtle place to be.
The standard picture would be to say that you measure something in both theories, and the something would be
right.
A scattering
for right.
Example.
But my credit, so I think what you're saying is that NRQED is a well-posed thing. I get the coefficients by matching, and I ask the questions. My argument is that that theory is not applying. It's not under control. So that what I think is going on, the analog of what I think is going on is, if I ask an analog of what I think is going on in this language where I do understand it, supposing I ask, how do I see, supposing I decide to perturb an H and just say, I don't care about boundary conditions, I'm just going to work perturbative in H, how do I see that I've got a problem? What's hard to see, it's subtle in momentum space, but it's obvious in position space, how you see that the perturbation theory breaks down in this case. Because if I've got a proton sitting here, and I propagate from here to here, you know, the electron might want to go there, it might want to bounce off the proton. But the thing that's dangerous is it bounces off the proton a whole bunch of times. Because each of these bounces is going like the electron propagator at zero, going to zero, in some non-zero time. And that's going like one over, you know, zero, basically. And so, although I get a factor of H every time I touch the proton, I'm getting a factor of H over zero, so it's a subtle question as to whether or not I've got control over perturbation theory. So if you sum these graphs, what they're telling you is that the propagator, so what I'm doing when I do this is I'm using the propagator who satisfies the boundary condition here, which would have been the one appropriate for the absence of a proton there. I'm just using the free propagator. If I sum these graphs, I would get a propagator, which is the free propagator, which obeys the boundary condition I've been selling to you. So in this language, if you had tried to ignore the boundary condition, the way that you see when you perturb around that you're doing something wrong is that the theory punishes you by showing you there's a big correction happening at the origin here. And that's how you see that the boundary condition is really changing. So what I suspect is happening, what should happen in NRQED, is that there should be contributions which in momentum space will look obscure because it's all going to look very ultraviolet. But part of it, if you did it in position space, what should happen is that there's a combination of repeated contact interactions, so you're, you know, fish, multiple fish diagrams, DNA diagrams, or whatever you call them, but also things where you have multiple exchanges of the electromagnetic field, which is the 1 over r squared part of it. And that's going to be a relativistic correction. That's the thing I don't quite see exactly how to translate into the NRQED language, but there should be some statement, which is the analog of the statement in this potential limit, that the inverse square potential is actually driving this contact interaction away from zero. And that, I don't quite see how to phrase it yet, but I'd like to be able to do that. And I think the way to do it is to do it in position space, because there you see the singularities that are tied up with things like the inverse square potential in an important way. But I think my main message in answer to you is that there's two criteria for the non-relativistic description. One is that omega is basically m, but the other one is that 1 over epsilon is much smaller than m. And that's the suspicious one. So the question is, how do you translate that into the NRQED statement when they say that they've got control over the approximation? There should be a translation of this statement somewhere, which I don't see in detail. If you do the relativistic problem, you can kind of see a transition. If you make this true, the Schrodinger equation becomes true, including boundary conditions. If you make this not.
That's what's right. What m is this there?
This is, they say, the electron mass there.
So we're applying electron mass much like the one
over some... Yeah, so this is the criterion that you do believe the Schrodinger equation, because it's that when you got closest, as close as you wanted to get to the source, you were still monophysic. So the electron does not satisfy. There's no electron.
You're making a statement that you can't take the dual problem as the unperturbed Hamiltonian. You need to add in another 1 over r squared piece. Is that the base statement that you're making?
I think that there should be an analog of that statement in our QED, which I don't see exactly how to make. But there's.
But, in order to access that 1 over r squared potential, that's a relativistic effect.
Right. So the language is not very well phrased for it in our QED. That's why I suspect that it's actually breaking down rather than like, there's an error that someone's made.
But I believe it's going to be packaged into contact interactions, which are part of an RQD. And contact interactions are both behaved as perturbations.
So pinning that belief down is exactly what I like to see, yeah.
But I guess what you're saying is contact interactions depend on the map and not interacting.
Well, they should. The running of them, there should be a translation of this classical running into the inner QD language. Maybe one way to get at it would be just to stick in an inverse square potential, forget the hydrogen atom, and just ask, how do you see that happen? And it should be possible to ask that question there, too. And then I think it's true that there should be a statement that the running of the contact interactions that I'm talking about here has an analog in NRQD.
In
NRQD,
you can assume that contact interactions are independent of what's in track, but the same for electron you want, or is it different?
That's implicitly got to be true, yeah.
Well, they're going to be different at some level.
But not powers of m, right? That's
if you can separate them into number of photon exchanges with the nucleus and charge radius contribution is defined as the one exchanging exactly one photon with the nucleus. We can go into a more precise definition of the charge radius in terms of the three-point function, proton, proton, proton. But there are effects coming from the two photon exchange with higher momentum flowing through a box diagram, and those depend on lepton mass. So the statement is certainly true that the contact interaction depends on mass in general.
But not as strongly, I think, as I'm selling here, right?
You're claiming a much stronger dependence.
Yeah. I think that, you know, your point is well taken, that really this whole story needs a clean contact to the party line, because that's either there's a mistake or there's a breakdown of validity of something, or I'm telling you bullshit. So the way to get that is to really pick apart the relationship to the standard calculation.
Let's thank Cliff again.
Yeah.